fingers in a fist, like you might run. A Dimension 20, The Unsleeping City podfic, written by Angel Once Was, and read to you by Fens and Marshes.
I wanna be everything to everyone. I wanna be what you want. I wanna hear you tell me I'm everything that I ever thought I was.
On Pete's first day at his room in Greenpoint, the Craigslist ad didn't say what it actually is, a converted walk-in closet, but honestly, it's not like he can be picky. He shuts the door and stands there, looking at the blank walls. You, Pete thinks to himself, are going to have to take care of yourself. Because his family, they're not going to do it. Neither is the guy on the other side of the door, young and suspicious and distant in a way that implies he has something to hide. Pete's not going to question it, but it does mean they're not about to be friends or anything. There's one person in the world looking out for Pete, and that means Pete's got to be looking out for that one person. It always comes back to himself now. When people ask, he tells them that the drugs serve that purpose. Mostly he tells them to fuck off, but sometimes regular clients ask questions, and he answers to keep good rapport. I do what I have to do to get by, he says plainly to the twins who peer at him with curious eyes. It's not like dealing is his fucking dream job, he just has to pay rent. One of them tilts her head in a way that looks like she's practiced it. Is it lonely? Pete thinks of the room he grew up in, a distant memory, even though he could be there, if he wanted, in a few hours. The fear he walks with, looking over his shoulder for the shadow of a face with his features. Seven, his supplier, one of the few people he talks to frequently, with his computer code name and happiness found in the whir of his monitors. With a gust of wind, Pete is brought back to the moment, two pseudo-strangers standing across from him. They're probably fishing for a discount, and Pete's not in the mood. He lets his jaw set. Are you buying or not? They quiet, whatever interest they had in him second to their interest in going home with weed. Pete leaves the corner with $50 cash and a kind of dizziness he can't place. On the way home, he sees something human-like fly by him on wings. But when he blinks and it's gone, he figures it's either the sleep deprivation or the acid, and takes another microdose. If you'd asked Pete the day before, a grown adult with a job, disregarding the fact that his job is one he can't put on tax forms, if Santa Claus was real, he probably wouldn't have laughed in your face, but he would have thought about doing it. For most people, finding that out is the first heartbreak of childhood. Pete's no exception. After sitting on his hunch till Christmas, he'd stayed up till late in the night with bated breath. When he'd heard his parents creep out of their room and whisper about putting presents under the tree, he'd been disappointed, wanting to be proven wrong, but not shocked. At that point, Santa had been more of a whimsical thought than a real person to thank for whatever gifts he'd managed to bring. Now, though? Now, Pete is shocked. Because Santa isn't just real, he's standing in front of Pete, freshly saved from some kind of abomination slug clone thing he'd just helped destroy, somehow. Santa is also, apparently, a bearer of moral judgment. Pete remembers the old nursery rhyme about him being all-seeing and can't help but scoff. Your soul is in danger, Santa says. I don't have a soul, Pete wants to say back, but even through his exhaustion and what is quickly becoming a headache, he can tell that's only going to sound childish, not philosophical, so he keeps it to himself. It's true, though. A soul implies a lot. Pete believes in himself most of all, his body and his thoughts. Even when they do fucking weird things, it's all he has. Sophia, one of the people he's just met, catches his eye and gives him a look of understanding. It's nice of her, she seems like a nice person, but also he doesn't want it because he doesn't think she understands at all. Pete feels a little hysterical. Maybe this is just what fucking happens when you get top surgery. Maybe he took something that was laced. Maybe he'll wake up in a couple minutes, bleary-eyed on his mattress, like always. Except it's been hours, and he's been more than pinched, and the world remains how it is. mint in his mouth, crashed sleigh in front of him. No one is acting like he's crazy, not for the whatever the fuck that poured out of his body earlier. If anything, they look at him with expectation in their eyes, like they're waiting for even more. When the group, if they can even be called that, Broadway star to weird-ass rat guy, get on the bus to the hospital, Alejandro looks at Pete with a grave expression. "Peter," he says, "you are what is known in arcane circles as a Vox Phantasmus." Pete runs the words over his tongue, between his teeth, swallows them down his throat, remembers the short period of time when he was interested in languages. "I'm a voice for the dreams?" "That is correct." "I'm a dream voice," Pete repeats aloud. He can't be serious. Alejandro has questions for him, and the celebrity is demanding he be honest, but really, he hasn't lived for this long by trusting any old person he comes across. Lying is comfortable. It's easy, it's a fail-safe. He's seen weird shit, especially today, but he's been through worse. They don't trust him. That's okay. He doesn't trust them, either. The part he doesn't say, even after Kingston's given him a look that has him telling everyone about what happened with his dad, is that it would mean a lot for them to be telling the truth. Before Pete was himself, when he didn't know fear or the burn of metal, when he was surrounded by the kind of love that most people are born into, his favourite person in the world was Spider-Man. The hero thing, that wasn't shocking. His dad had some vintage comics in his office, and they watched a lot of movies. His mum indulged his interest like she did his much earlier love for rubber ducks. Still, in the years later, if he stopped to really dissect it, it would make sense. Pete wasn't like Batman, rich and brooding. He wasn't otherworldly like Superman. He was just a kid, a guy, who, tragedy aside, would have loved to be special. To have a purpose. To mean something more than what everyone thinks they mean. Than what everyone seemed to think he meant. After everything's wound down and he is settled, unsettled mostly, but given a place to stay by a guy who seems cool enough, he opens the box he saved from Mitch's clutches and finds, at the bottom, a shoddily coloured-in Spider-Man. A lump rises in his throat, and he wakes up early the next morning to burn it, the lighter he's had for years curling its edges. As he catches his reflection in the apartment lobby window, Pete wonders vaguely if that's what he really looks like, if that's how people see him, but before he can process it, the image ripples. Instead of acting as a mirror, there stands the grey kid he saw before, a sad expression on its haunting face. Suddenly, he regrets what he's doing. Pete throws the paper on the ground to stomp out the fire. But at that point, he's just left with a dirty and wet wad of what was a childhood hero. He puts it in his pocket anyway, unable to throw it out, and treads carefully back up the stairs, stopping when he opens the door to Kingston's apartment, and Kingston himself is there, facing him. "What were you doing out there?" Kingston asks when he comes back in. Pete stares blankly over one of his shoulders. "I don't know what you're talking about." Kingston raises an eyebrow, deliberately scanning what must be the red on his skin from the cold, the lighter still very conspicuously in his hand, and the jacket he almost certainly didn't sleep in. Lying is easy. Getting people to believe you isn't. Pete has to wonder if anything good ever comes out of caring. For a while, he thought the problem was the people he cared about, like Priya. He loved Priya, loved her so much he still jumps every time his phone vibrates, still feels a spark down his ribcage before his brain can remember that it's not her and he should be grateful that it isn't. Or his family. He loved them first, only leaving because that didn't mean anything to them. 3 times, though, that's a pattern. The only thing all these very different relationships have in common is him. Pete doesn't love Kingston and the gang, hasn't known any of them for long enough. But the rush of emotion that comes as he watches them debate killing him is familiar, almost warm. Some of the drugs he has, they don't actually make you feel good. You just get addicted to whatever they have to offer. He's seen his clients want the drop just as much as the rest of it. He's always steered clear of them because of that. He probably should have been just as careful in other areas. That must have been out of context or something, Pete insists. Robert's got some kind of motive here, so Pete's confident about not trusting him, but he can hear the desperation that seeps into his voice anyway, the lack of sureness. Maybe if he believed in them more, he wouldn't be so unsteady, but he isn't, and they aren't either, clearly. So he lets Robert lead him into the nightclub. He looks at the vampires. Pete remembers what he said about the way people want and what he does to get by. Robert's voice is smooth and sincere. Pete knows conniving men when he sees them. It's this little grey kid that made you this thing, against your will, Robert says, sympathetic. That kid, mournful in the window, warning in Pete's dreams. Something about Robert's words sound like lies, even though he knows they're true, that they align with what Alejandro has told him. It's not like he decided to be Vox Phantasma. He didn't even know that was a fucking thing. Black eyes meet his in the mirror on the wall, and everything speeds up. As Robert moves towards the kid, pulled from wherever it came from with some kind of blood, something comes over Pete. Something that reminds him of a quiet house upstate. Of things he's long forgotten, of that now-dried paper still tucked into his pocket. He's not what everyone wants, he's a lying drug dealer who's been saddled with this job, but he can be a hero. Pete moves quick, quicker than makes sense, and holds Nod as tight as he can to his chest. He watches with a sort of distance as glowing power explodes out of his body, inexplicable as always. Horror settles deep in him as he watches the kid go impossibly greyer, beginning to crack in odd places, in a way skin absolutely shouldn't. Nod's smile, while weak, is nothing but sweet.
I knew I chose right,
Nod whispers, trembling as it cranes its neck to kiss Pete's cheek. The magic surges inside of Pete and he can't hold on anymore. When he opens his eyes, they are at the Lorimer Street subway stop, and Pete doesn't have time to unpack that, because he has never been more sure of what death feels like, that he is witnessing it firsthand, that this little kid is going through something awful, something Pete knows he doesn't fully understand. Robert's words ring in his head, and if the situation was a little bit different, Pete knows he would be laughing. The man sees the word a certain way, phrased it all as a bad thing. Expectation saddled onto an unwilling participant. There is that. There's the fact that not long ago, Pete's life was not easy, but uncomplicated. Simple. His biggest concern was himself because that's all he had to worry about. There's the fact that this has only made him more different, and even those who are familiar with magic still see him as an outsider. This is not a fairy tale or a childhood dream. No one's here to take him home. And yet, of all of Pete's thoughts, the one that comes to the forefront is bright and clear. Nod chose me. He was picked, determined by this otherworldly being, by this kid delicate in his arms, to be worthy of representing the dreaming. He was deemed special, made important. Nod saw magic in Pete before he saw any of it. The thought thrums through his veins as everyone who didn't choose him, who would have chosen someone else, arrives, helping. Pete can't do this on his own, doesn't know how to get to the dream world other than with Nod's help, but he has no time for pride, all of his focus on the shaky breaths being taken by smaller lungs. He lets the mind link between him and Kingston lay open, strung across the battlefield like rust on a phone line. He gives Alejandro all the magic he can to call the train to Dreamland that apparently exists. He covers the kid with his body, ready to take any blows he has to. In Nod, its manifested namesake heals easily. Nod glides across the cloud cover floor, dark eyes wide. Kingston, meanwhile, is simply walking on sidewalk that appears in front of him. Pete sees the dichotomy between them in literal form, this man made of all the things every person who sees New York, and will never see Nod, is made of. I owe you an apology, Kingston had said through their link, and an explanation. Too much is going on to expect it now, but there's still the twinge of something tight and hard in his chest as these people he's with frolic through the land of the dreaming. Pete takes a deep breath, holds it, and lets it out. Nod gestures towards him, expectant, and Pete follows. The diner they go to is as mystical as anything else, but it's cozy and casual enough for Pete to relax a little. The food is good, sans the egg cream, and in the booth, Nod nestles towards him like a loved one, head against his arm. Pulling his arm, and Nod by proxy, toward him affectionately, Pete is rewarded with a smile, then some strange purple pills as the kid cups his hands together to conjure them. Oddly enough, the gesture reminds Pete of his dad. Not the childhood memories, but the confrontation that started all of this, the past staring him physically in the face, and the distance between himself and it. Pete has never been good at letting go, but he's an expert at moving on, sometimes even before he's ready, but always just when he needs to. He's changed his whole life before. It was hard. It felt unreal at times. It was always more than worth it. Every dollar and free moment, all the time he spent introducing himself as who he is and living how he wanted. He got that by taking a leap. Nod chose him, cares about him. Even just for the sake of the bigger picture, he has people looking out for him now. Pete remembers Sophia defending him in the footage Robert showed him, new as he is and still willing to challenge her main link to the unsleeping city. He remembers Ricky's offer to go to the gym together for healthier habits or whatever. Misty's strength in battle and Kugrash's wisdom and Kingston, who said he could put Pete down, who is Pete's equivalent on the other side, the true guardian of the city they all live in. Kingston, who nods when Pete looks at him, acknowledging. Cupping his hand around Nod's, Pete accepts the pills to keep them out of the kid's hands, stowing them away in his pocket.
You saved my life, Nod says. And I think, for whatever it's worth, Pete, you're a pretty good hero.
This means a lot to me.
Pete looks around the table at each of his companions, knowing what they've said, knowing now who they are, who he is, a little more, thinking about the panic that gripped him barely an hour ago. There's tension in his voice and he knows it, hoping they understand what he's really trying to say. He turns back to Nod.
Thank you, he says quietly. Thanks.
There is still, clearly, a lot to know. Not just about the world and its magic, but his specific role in it. About Robert, too, the threats that go beyond the battles they've had, beyond anything Pete's ever known. So they sit in the diner and make plans, learn what little they can in the time they have. Pete cries when he finds out Nod's given him a piece of itself. He can't help it. He tucks the kid tighter against him and breathes. I'm going to take care of you, Pete thinks fiercely. Nod, as though it hurt, reaches down and grabs his hand tightly. The conversation continues. Magic swirls around them, snow reaching endlessly towards the sky outside. Tomorrow it doesn't loom, but it does wait. Pete can feel it, as tangible as the warmth of the people around him.
You said I was hopeless then, what am I now? Will I ever figure out where if it all inside this world I fit somehow?
The end. Thank you for listening. This was Fingers in a Fist, Like You Might Run, by Angel Once Was.